It's Bonus Pod 263.
You open your eyes and you're in a sort of alien, you're pretty confused. It's all that moment right after you wake up in the morning after a dream. You can't tell what's real and where you are. And you start to realize you're lying in a sort of in a street, in a cobbled street in London. It looks like London, but not the real London, a sort of idealized version of London. It's kind of a London an American would imagine. Cobbled streets, those old black lampposts, red post boxes and telephone boxes, and people living very central at a rental price one can only dream of. And you think, what? Where am I? And you start to piece together your memories of what happened before you woke up, and you think, well, I went to cinema, the Prince Charles Cinema in London, and they were playing a sort of Richard Curtis retrospective, a sort of ironic Richard Curtis retrospective, and that's it. My friend dared me to touch the screen, and when I touched the screen, I've zipped into, I'm in the Richard Curtis movie! And you look around and everyone's white. It's very white. It's a very white vision of London. There are a few characters of colour on the periphery, but you notice they're not making any noise with their mouths. and you look around and a beautiful lady or man, depending on what you're attracted to, hovers over you and says, are you all right? You took a bit of a tumble there. And they reach out their hand and you grab it and they pull you up and you go, yes, sorry, I'm just a bit confused and sort of charming, I suppose. And you said charming without really expecting to. And go, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say charming. And instead of finding this despicable and annoying, as a normal human would, this person laughs and goes, you're not like the others, are you? And you go, oh, I suppose I'm not, no. And they go, anyway, come on then, we're late for my sister's art gallery opening. And you go, oh, yes, of course. And she says, it's right, or he says, it's right here. And you go into this little gallery opening and everyone there is clinking glasses and they're all white. And they go, and someone goes, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Bloody Bloops gallery exhibition. We're very excited to have this up and coming talented person who is also attractive and might pose a threat to your relationship if your relationship is sort of the protagonist relationship in a story. And everyone goes, ha ha ha. And they say, please welcome Anne Bubbles. And Anne Bubbles turns up. And she's incredibly tall. And she's so tall because she's Phil and Pierre. Phil stood on Pierre's shoulders wearing an extremely long dress, a hauntingly long dress. And Phil on Pierre's shoulders goes, hello. Ah, well, thank you for coming. It's very exciting today to reveal my latest art. Behold, and the curtain on the wall drops, and there's a painting of you, Podbud. It's shaped in a, it's got a ring, a heart around it, and your portrait is made with, it can't be, and Phil on Pierre's shoulders goes, that's right, feces. Oh, and the camera pans out, and the and it says the end, and the title of the Richard Curtis movie was Two Poos and a Proposal. Welcome to Bonus Pod.
Horrible. Haunting in its own way.
Yeah.
I like the description of the non-white characters not making any noise with their mouths.
Yeah, I'm the only one, but it's because I'm half white, and the volume of my voice is half the volume of everyone else, as I should have said.
Yeah, they went through the mix, and they made sure your voice was 50% as loud as everyone else, which is why in the movie you had to shout your lines, But it doesn't seem like you're shouting them. You just seem really weird.
Yeah, I'm making the face of shouting, but the volume is normal volume.
Yeah, there's like veins in your neck, and like we can see your top and bottom teeth, but it's still just like, hey guys, how's it going?
The quality of the voice is the quality of screaming, but the volume is speaking volume is very unsettling. It's like kind of speaking in a nightmare.
Yeah, yeah, that would be quite good for like an artistic film. This idea of screaming turned down and people talk at a normal volume to this character. I like this, actually.
Yes, that is interesting.
It's horrible.
Yeah,
that's fun.
Do you like the title Two Poos and a Proposal?
What I like is that, obviously, I like the fact that it's two poos. That's funny because it's about poo and there's two of them and very good.
Yeah,
but I like the idea that a whole movie would be about a proposal. So unresolved, so not enough.
Ah, yes, that's right.
Cliffhanger.
Well, it begs a sequel.
It does. It does. It falls to its knees and begs a sequel.
Yeah.
I guess two wipes and a yes. or something. A flush and a yes.
Did you watch the Richard Curtis movies? I'm sure you did. We all did.
Yes.
We all had mothers.
We all had sisters. Well, we didn't all, but you know what I mean.
But the sisters were... Our sisters were too young to elect to watch a Richard Curtis movie, surely.
I don't know, man. My older sister was 5 years older, so...
Oh.
You know... Yeah. Which I always get confused which ones were his. I often misremember.
Love Actually.
Yeah.
Four Weddings and a Funeral.
Yeah.
Pretty Woman? Did he do Pretty Woman?
Ooh, I'm not sure. About the prostitute or sex worker or whatever you're supposed to say.
The sex woman. Pretty Woman, Richard Curtis? No, Sitting Richard Gere. I don't think it was then, no.
No, okay. He's always doing little British ones. Little quirky British. It is odd now, actually. I will say this, Phil. Four
Weddings and a Funeral, Notting Hill, of course. Bridget Jones's Diary, Love Actually. Mr. Bean's Holiday, fair enough.
Very sexy, very sexy.
He did War Horse. Huh. Mamma Mia.
Yeah.
Yesterday. Okay.
I'll say
Four Weddings and a Funeral. Wow, that's pretty early on. That's his third movie.
Yeah, man.
Gosh.
I'll say this, Phil, for diversity. It has meant the increased diversity on our screens does mean that when I go back and watch something like Notting Hill or Four Weddings and a Funeral, it's weird.
Yeah.
Whereas it definitely wasn't weird at the time.
No, it wasn't. It just was mysteriously bright for the whole movie. You couldn't quite put your finger on why.
Yeah.
I honestly remember thinking those movies were very bright. I thought, well, they're a bright movie.
Yeah, there's more lightness on the screen in some way that I find hard to define.
Yeah,
all those close-ups of very pale thighs and forearms. Ah, so bright. Hundreds of acres of white flesh. Yeah.
Yeah.
It does feel weird.
I feel like when I was a kid after watching those movies, I think part of me on some level was convinced that only white people ever fell in love. And I think I did find sort of Asian romantic relationships to be quite odd. I was like, are they just copying the white people? Honestly, I think I did sort of internalize that feeling.
That's such a devastating thing to hear, Phil. I think that's too sad to count as spice. I think I remember there being a period where everything was so incredibly white that one of the things that made it difficult to introduce an Asian or a black character was that it was only ever done as part of a broader point that was being made.
Yes.
So I remember the confusion would be in the mind of a very white viewer would be like, okay, but why is specifically that character black?
Yes. What are they saying about
what are they
that character's place in the story,
yes,
in the world?
Is the writer setting this up? Because like it's important that woman in the movie, her love interest is a black guy because there's going to be some racial tension later with the old father.
Mm.
Or is there going to be something to do with that? And the big difference now is diversity with no intentional meaning behind it at all. Kind of ambient diversity.
That's right. There was, in the noughties, if there was a mixed race couple in a movie, you were guaranteed a dinner at the parents' house scene where it came up.
Yes.
Guaranteed.
Yes. And it was artistic foreshadowing. You knew it was coming. There was going to be an argument.
It was Chekhov's melanin, Pierre. It had to be addressed in Act 3, at least. You introduce the melanin in Act 1, and it has to go off in Act 3.
Oh. I nearly spat coffee there. That was very dangerous. Chekhov's melanin is perfect. Yeah, and that was part of the rocky... Well, no, it wasn't really rocky, was it? That was part of the gradual transition to ambient diversity. You start feeding in more and more diverse performers, and gradually your brain just goes, okay, well, it doesn't necessarily mean anything.
Yeah.
It might, but also... Do you think you
can? So what you're saying, Pierre, is that in order to achieve our current state of ambient representation or ambient diversity, as you say, we had to go through this clumsy transitionary period. And although we might sort of make fun of him and his ilk now, Richard Curtis and the like did us all a great service, really.
Well, did he do the crowbarring in of diversity?
Well, this is it. I don't know any of his movies well enough to actually say this imagined a character of color actually exists in any of his movies. It's just
I don't think it does. I think the one thing he gets credit for in Four Weddings and a Funeral is having a touching gay relationship.
Ah!
Which...
Well, you can only spin so many plates at once, Pierre.
Well, like, it's funny, isn't it? Because what Four Weddings and a Funeral was 90s, wasn't it?
94.
Yeah, but we forget, Phil. 94, you could get a column in the Sun saying that homosexuals deserved AIDS and were disgusting perverts.
It's true.
It's a fucking mainstream opinion. So
that is true.
We forget so quickly how absolutely horrifying the past was in so many ways.
That is true.
So credit for that, I suppose. But still, as you say, overwhelmingly bright, bright screens of... White.
Oh, so Love Actually was his directorial debut. So I guess he produced the others.
Yeah.
Or screenwrote. He screenwrote.
Yeah. Because Notting Hill was directed by Roger Michell, of course.
Yes. Yes.
So, okay. So do you, well, is that, is, it's not even spicy. It can't count as spice because what we're saying is mainstream and highly endorsed, especially in our business.
That is true. Well, but is the spice that these clumsy transitionary pieces of culture are, you know, you can make fun of them now, but they were important to get us to where we are.
I think that's only...
Is that widely accepted?
I don't know. I say it's spicy if we wrote it in the Daily Mail. It's barely worth publishing in The Guardian.
Fair enough.
Because in The Guardian, they already think that it was good, and they thought it was good at the time. The crowbarring. Do you have any spice?
Okay. Okay, how about this?
Okay.
It feels to me like the people are saying the rom-com is back. The rom-com is coming back.
Oh, okay.
And looking at this, you know, the previous golden age of rom-coms was early noughties.
Ah.
Is it spicy to say that as global instability... increases and the threat of a global war, a new world war increases, the desire for rom-coms increases?
Aha. I think that sounds right. I think people,
because the last golden age was right after 9/11, right after Iraq. You know?
Yeah, comfort food. Yes, comfort food. I remember reading something about men's haircuts correlating with war and the popularity of that war.
Oh, interesting. Okay, how so? Do you remember?
So if you're at war, then, you know, military fashion takes off like we saw, you know, literally trench coats from World War One. Mm. You know, that's a military piece of clothing. It's a military piece of equipment for fighting in a trench. And it was popular. And the idea
was popular during the war.
Yeah, well, it came from the war. But because the war was popular, it was popular.
Oh.
Whereas if the war is unpopular and stigmatized, you don't want to dress like the war.
Yes, that's interesting.
And so at the start of the 60s, all the men had short haircuts. And as the Vietnam War became unpopular in America, they had their hair long. Because long hair is the opposite of military hair.
Yeah.
So there's maybe a correlation between that and...
But what sort of visual signifiers are there for being part of a modern British army? I mean... It's not stuff that you'd be wearing, you could wear in normal day life anyway.
No, but that's partially because military fashion is so embedded in actual fashion now that, like, someone can have little tabs with a button on their shoulder and you just think, oh, that's just a jacket.
Have you seen people going around with these backpacks that look like US Marine backpacks?
I have seen some pretty military backpacks around.
Yeah, and I'm like, are they a veteran or is this just something you can buy now?
You can just buy them from military surplus. In fairness, like, I had a friend who... There's a type of really massive British Army rucksack that is for, like, you know, like serious hiking.
Mm.
And it's really good. I mean, it's an incredible rucksack and it can hold so much. And a friend of mine bought one, but he didn't want to seem like he was someone who used to be in the army because he wasn't. And he thought, you know... And he dyed it black. He just dyed it.
Oh, yeah, fair enough.
To benefit from military technology without seeming like a poseur.
Yeah, sure. But what is the technology in these bags? Just very cleverly laid out compartments? Good materials?
A lot of space. You know, waterproof or semi-waterproof. Gore-Tex linings, lots of side pockets. It's just, you know. And they're pretty cheap because it's military surplus.
Mm.
So if you want one with a brand on it, like Arc'teryx or whatever.
Mm.
Then it's going to really fucking cost you.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So that's probably why. Here's something I noticed being on tour with Frank Skinner. A lot more men outside of London wear camo.
Like...
Not loads, but in London, I never see anyone wearing camo. Whereas...
Well, then it works.
Oh, wow!
They're just better at doing it.
I'm walking through dense foliage, I don't see it. I'm walking through the park, I don't see it. I'm walking at night. But no, like genuinely, like regional towns and even cities, Manchester, whatever, Liverpool, I'll see a guy with some camo trousers. I might see a guy with a camo jacket.
Mm. Mm.
I just don't see it in London.
That's true. I wonder what that is.
Maybe it's a bit like 80s metal to wear camo. It's a bit...
I also think the East London fashion influence is extremely strong in London. And if camo isn't part of that, it's not going to be part of
it's true.
Most people's...
It's also probably why, like, I don't see as many mullets.
Is there
and
also something about, although you have named other big cities, is there something to being more left-leaning and less likely to wear army coded clothing?
Definitely. Outside of punk or whatever. But yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right. Do I have any spice this week? My spice is that everyone should buy my book.
That's a spicy take.
That's my pretty spicy take, is that everyone on earth should own a copy of my book, like I'm fucking Mao. here's my spicy take. I read a review in the Times of a book, and the review was so devastating. It was such a disembowelment that it has given me the fear.
Oh gosh, what book, or if you don't want to say, what kind of book were they reviewing?
It was a very modern book about how, you know, to do with sort of like. Nominally to do with feminism, but it was reviewed by a woman. It was written by a woman, reviewed by a woman. And the woman who reviewed it basically just went through the whole thing saying, this literally doesn't make sense. This isn't even the right word that she's used.
Mm.
This is wrong. This is just historically wrong. This, again, is another quite complex term that she's actually saying the opposite. She means the opposite of what she said.
Right.
And
right,
I would find that level of failing to fact check my own work so embarrassing. I think I'd walk into the sea.
But is that very impulse that means you have done your fact checking and then you have done your due diligence?
Yeah, but I've checked the fuck out of it. But
yeah,
I still know I've missed stuff out. You can't write a book about everything at once, you know.
Yeah, but no reasonable person can accuse you of omission in the same way they can accuse you of being flat out wrong.
Just
about
straight
what you
up
said.
Wrong. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
I've also sent the book. Obviously, I've given a copy readers of the book to Phil.
Yes.
But I have also given copies of the book to more frightening people.
Frightening in what sense? In the reviewer sense?
People who I people who I would be very, like, I would be shy about approaching them.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Intimidating people who have less of a personal relationship with me, who are sort of doing me much more of a favor by reading it.
Gotcha.
And that's frightening as well. I mean, did you have anything like that with yours?
Yeah. When I wrote my book, I sent it. Okay, they asked you to come up with a list of people you'd like to send an advanced copy to. And, you know, there are a couple of big names on that. Couple, one or two just didn't get back, and that's fine.
Yeah.
And then I got some really big names get back to me, and some people I really respected get back to me, and that was more than enough. I was very, very chuffed with that. Also, a couple of very busy people got. I don't know how the busy people got back to me having read the book. I thought that was extraordinary. I've got a suite of quotes I'm very happy with. So,
but was it not?
As long as you cast a wide net, you're fine.
Was it not terrifying, Philippe?
No, because I've seen big quotes on so many books.
Yeah, that's
from
true.
Big people, you know.
That's true. Well, we'll see.
And the worst they can do is not read it.
Yes, that's true. The worst they could do is for some reason read it and then write an excoriating review in the Times.
Right,
they won't do that.
I don't think so, they will, because the subject matter you are talking about is not really, not yet anyway, a sort of, it's not really a domain of internecine warfare
that
a lot of culture wars are.
That's true. And the people I've sent it to are people who I admire and respect, and they've been very kind to accept it. I haven't had any no responses yet.
I haven't sent had... Everyone's responded, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, great.
Yeah,
great.
I mean, I haven't sent it to a fucking 100 people, but still. Okay.
It'll be great, man.
We'll see. We'll see. Pre-order available now, etc., etc. Do you have any big spice, Phil? Anything occur to you?
What the bloody hell is... Oh, well, today is the day this fucking Rwanda bill has been passed in the UK.
Oh, right, yeah.
Which is just thoroughly embarrassing. And I guess my hot take is... My spicy take is... Oh, it's not spicy, though. Who doesn't know this is thoroughly embarrassing? My spicy take is actually, on a hopeful note, that we don't have to be... Hopefully, we won't have to be embarrassed about ourselves for very much longer.
Yes, that's good. Hopefully.
My spicy take is thank God the Tories have been as shit as they have.
Yeah, in a way.
So as to make it completely clear they need to go and sort of wanting to go themselves.
Yeah, they're like someone who is trying to get thrown out of a nightclub and they're standing on the dance floor. They're shitting, they're pissing, they're screaming, they're throwing bottles in the air. And for whatever reason, the bouncers are going to take another 4 months to throw them out.
What is with Rishi Sunak's reticence to call the general election, do you think? Do you actually... is it as simple as, well, if I can be Prime Minister of the UK for a few months longer, why not?
Yes, it is, yeah. And also, like, why get up from the blackjack table till you've run out of money?
Yeah.
The longer I stay on the blackjack table, maybe... Keir Starmer will get caught literally killing a child.
Yeah.
And that might halve Labour's lead to 12 points instead of fucking 24 on some polls. We should do some Vipco quickly.
All right.
So, it is a message from, how does he sign off? John, the man of touching cloth.
Ah, the John of touching cloth. Good to hear from you again.
Yes. So, John was the one who, oh, yes, yes, yes. The vomit-soaked nightclub in Birmingham.
The what?
He was at that nightclub in Birmingham and threw up everywhere, I think. Anyway.
Oh.
Dear, I can... This is good. Dear, I can feel it calling in Pierre tonight. Oh,
really good.
Oh, no.
Excellent.
Very
one of my
nice.
Faves.
I've been waiting to correspond about some shite.
Nice.
Oh, no.
Very
is that
good. Your line or their line?
All of it is theirs.
Nice.
I've been meaning to send this email for a good while now, but have been very busy living the bum bum life. Namely, my one-year-old son's bum bum, which has been endlessly shitting all over my previously nice clean house.
Yes. That happens.
This week's bonus pod, well, this is a while ago, this week's bonus pod where Phil dropped the bombshell that he's seemingly never heard a dog before. Oh, yeah, you were doing... Blap, blap. You were doing...
Oh, ba-da-da, 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 ba-da-da. That's my bark, yeah. I think that was it.
Yeah, and referencing Surf and Turf reminded me to forward on my big bag of plops. Firstly, thanks to Pierre for a great night in Exeter back in October. I wasn't expecting such an interactive experience, but that's what you get for wearing a brightly coloured Grateful Dead t-shirt in the front row of a centrist dad stand-up show. Correct. I must admit, I partially wore it to provoke you a little, as I've held a long-time grudge since episode 23, when you called Tame Impala the new Grateful Dead in response to Phil saying, I love them tunes, but wow, the fans are annoying.
Wow, that early on, huh, I knew.
That really hurt, actually. Anyway... I'm here to regale you with a wee memory which was rudely awakened by Pierre's piss goblin story from his show. You find our hero at the same place we last met, a now vomit-soaked nightclub in Birmingham.
Wow, is he ever anywhere else?
No. No! At the end of another evening of drunken debauchery and shedding my stomach lining, I headed outside with the rest of the sweaty rabble of Birmingham's rock scene to have a smoke. And probably barf a little more and wait for a taxi.
Oh, it is nice, actually.
Yeah. When I overheard a conversation between a couple of guys I knew. Mm. Quote, yeah, he's always here. I told you, man, it's fucking insane. I stumbled over to them, intrigued as to the subject of their passionate exchange. Who's this, then? I nosily inquired.
A catchphrase from our very podcast is, what's this, then?
What's this, then?
Oh, what's this?
What's this? Sorry, what's this? What's this?
Sorry, what's this?
Sorry, what are we laughing about? Who's this then? I nosily inquired. The piss troll, they both loudly exclaimed in unison.
In Birmingham?
One
On
of
tour?
Them explained to me that there was a man who stood under the bridge over the canal that the club was built above.
Oh.
Over the cut, as they say in Birmingham. Oh, yeah, there's a piss troll there. Stands under the bridge by the cut. Loves a bit of piss. One of them explained that there was a man who stood under the bridge over the canal that the club was built above who would magically appear at the first whiff of a dribble of urine.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so he's under the bridge.
He's lurking under the bridge. And so when someone pisses...
And people are pissing over the bridge?
Yeah.
Ah.
Yeah.
God. Wow.
So, bollocks, I exclaim, as I ran over to the bridge, hurriedly whipping out the little fella and beginning to do the deed. Lo and behold, within seconds of my stream hitting the ground, a wild piss troll appeared.
No! Extraordinary.
A man in his 50s with a greasy mullet.
Well, that's not who I was picturing.
Was it not?
No, I don't know.
For a
piss
troll?
I expected sort of a bald, I expected a bald guy. I think that's it.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know why.
Well, I guess if you were bald, then you could get more of a piss feeling hitting you from above.
Yeah, you'd have more of a tank, like a piss shower, a bit of piss shower. Whereas with a mullet, you're getting piss in your mullet.
I think, but he likes that.
Oh, yeah.
He's going to walk home going, oh, yeah, I got some piss in my mullet.
Yes.
For later. Lovely.
Gosh, wow.
Yeah, a man in his 50s with a greasy mullet was suddenly standing directly in my wake. That's funny.
Nice.
In my memory, this all happened in slow motion as he flicked his hair from side to side. Oh, like in a shampoo advert.
Wow.
Oh, he says
really
that.
Loves it.
As he flicked his hair from side to side and rubbed my sugary stream of barely filtered Jack and Coke into his scalp like a Pantene Pro P advert.
Oh, man. This is extraordinary.
Wow. It may not have actually been quite as graceful as in my recollection, but the guy certainly enjoyed himself even more than I did, even more than I enjoyed unleashing this colossal whiz.
If it's clear the other person is loving it,
yeah,
and you're able to discard the guilt, the natural guilt of pissing on someone. Once you get through that barrier, maybe it is fine.
Well.
It's fun.
He says, with the power of slightly more PC hindsight, the glitz and glamour of this memory is somewhat besmirched by the harrowing reality that I probably spent many a Friday night for 2 years after this event pissing on a mentally ill man while intoxicated.
But I tried this again?
Huh? Well, just because he kept... Again? Well, if you keep going to that nightclub and keep pissing and you don't look down every time, he's down there.
Right, wow.
So he's presuming.
Yeah.
But I tried to hold on to the glimmer of hope that he was merely a sane man who happened to know exactly what he wanted. To be anonymously drenched in piss by a series of 16 to 25-year-old guys from 30 feet above.
Mm.
I mean,
I think he knew what he was doing.
Of course.
It sounds like it takes a lot of, like... It takes, like, scheduling and...
Yeah.
Timing to get that done to yourself. And, I think you're fine.
Imagine the moment when he figured it out.
That he could get this piss for free under the bridge?
Yeah. Yes. He was walking along and he sees, like, oh, that's that bridge those young men always piss over. Wait a minute. I could lurk beneath that bridge.
Wow.
Eureka!
There's something kind of fantastical about it. I think about anything emerging from under a bridge is something fantastical about.
Yeah.
I like the story a lot more than the Piss Goblin story, who is just chained to a urinal, right?
Yeah. So you find this more romantic?
Yeah. It feels more like something I'd come across in an Elder Scrolls game. Whereas the Piss Goblin is just kind of too... It's just vile. He's outside. He's in the open air. I think that's why he's less gross.
So you heard it, folks. The Piss Goblin is out. The Piss Troll is in. In our fashion.
I know it's hard to keep up with these fashions, but...
Yeah. Okay, that's interesting. I like the idea of him emerging to the sound of Hall of the Mountain King.
How does that go?
Like a dwarf in a tale.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, and he's there showering in the piss. The Alton Towers music.
Well, thank you, John, so much for...
Yeah.
Almost like a fairy tale.
Yeah, for bringing a bit of who's the guy who wrote all the fairy tales?
Grimm?
Yeah.
Brothers Grimm?
Brothers Grimm.
And very grim this was.
Brothers Piss, yeah. So thank you, John.
Thank you, John, and thank you, patrons, for your lovely Patreon.
Yes, thank you, guys.
Please remember to pre-order Pierre's book.
Yeah, and come to the Bloomsbury, 22nd of June.
Aside from that, love you lots and speak to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.